Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk. We have a huge docket for you today, so let's tell you what we've got for you. First, Barry Morphew has motions hearings today. Alex Murdoch got a bond. An update on the Michigan school massacre. Derek Chauvin's going to plead guilty in federal court. An interesting issue coming to courts everywhere regarding cell phone data. Those responsible for the death of Ahmaud Arbery, well, they have a sentencing date. Reasons why you shouldn't go around trying to hurt people. Well, you're going to get caught. A looting grandma video you've got to see. And then finally, our dumb criminal of the day. Let's talk about it. It is Tuesday, December 14th, 2021. Let's get to the docket. But before we do, if you haven't done so already, please hit that subscribe button. Hit that little bell so you receive notifications when we go live or put up new content. Why is that important? Well, tonight is our Tuesday night live, and we have a guest this evening, a private investigator that does work with me, and we've known each other for a long time. I think you'll find his story rather interesting. All right, let's get to it. First, Barry Morphew, he has a motions hearing today. It's set for multiple days, and we'll see what actually happens today. The motions hearings today are held basically for discovery issues. As you may recall, early on, the defense is saying they have not received all of the information in this case. And as we brought you before, Barry Morphew has sued the police officers, the district attorneys involved in this case, for basically failing to turn over exculpatory evidence. And that's going to be the gist of what is being talked about today. It is not being covered via WebEx. We will bring you the information as it becomes available. And next on the docket, Alex Murdoch gets the bond. That's right. Disgraced ex-attorney Alex Murdoch spoke publicly for the first time in months on Monday in front of a judge. Now, Mr. Murdoch blamed some of his problems on his 20-year-long opioid addiction. Now, shortly after, the judge set his bond at $7 million. That's right. Now, the bond hearing centered on the charges handed down by a grand jury totaling 48 counts of breach of trust and fraudulent intent, computer crimes, money laundering, and forgery. The entire $7 million bond must be posted for Alex Murdoch to go on house arrest with electronic monitoring. He would have to get counseling and be randomly drug tested. Now, this all came down from Circuit Judge Allison Renee Lee in a virtual hearing. Now, Mr. Murdoch described to the court his frame of mind leading up to the events of that alleged day. He said that he had met with his brother and another law firm partner to confess a 20-year-long hidden addiction and to discuss my actions in the 24 hours before the attempted killing. He also said he was going through opioid withdrawal at the time. Now, Mr. Murdoch said he knew he had tarnished the family's legacy, but that he had improved since September and has not used any opioids in more than 3 months. Mr. Murdoch stated in court that his head is on straighter. He's thinking clearer than he has in a long, long time. He also wanted to deal with the charges appropriately and head on. He wants to repair as much of the damage that he has done, and he wants to repair many of the relationships, as many as he can. Now, on Monday, the attorneys for both Murdoch and the deceased housekeeper Gloria Satterfield's son announced during the bond hearing that some victims were nearing resolution with Mr. Murdoch, who is also accused of stealing insurance money meant for the Satterfield sons. The lawyers for both Murdoch and the Satterfield family said Murdoch had agreed to a $4.3 million judgment in this case, which is obviously subject to the approval of the court-appointed receivers, who now control all of his assets. Now, Judge Lee's bond order surpassed amounts recommended by both prosecutors, who had recommended that the judge set the bond at only $6.2 million, which he's only accused of stealing $4.7, according to them. That's about $100,000 for each count. Now, Mr. Murdoch's defense attorney had asked that the judge set the bond at a maximum of $200,000. As indicated, they would ask the judge to reconsider her decision. His attorney stated that he can't post $7 million. He can't post $700,000, according to his defense attorneys. He has no money. Now, the judge probably did the right thing by setting a bond. Most people are entitled to a bond unless it is a capital offense. Mr. Murdoch has not been charged with a capital offense. And the judge made a statement before setting the bond at $7 million. She stated that about media reports questioning why she and not the judge who had been assigned to all of Mr. Murdoch's criminal cases would be here today. She said an act of good faith by the Supreme Court that she was now presiding over the matters. She said, quote, "The reason I'm presiding and not Judge Clinton Newman is because I'm the presiding judge of the state grand jury." To summarize, what the judge said was a judge was put in place to build trust with a wary public. The judge made a decision that wasn't favorable to Mr. Murdoch. In a bold and very drastic move, Murdoch's attorney seems to have tattled on the judge and tried to go around his decision. If that doesn't work, so then the public is told there's a new judge for bond decisions. At the time of the hearing, Mr. Murdoch faced three charges related to the Labor Day shooting incident, two charges from the Satterfield case, and 48 charges from 12 indictments handed down by the grand jury in November and this December. So that would add up to 53 charges. Well, in this case, using Mr. Murdoch's math, the charges add up to 51. This is because two of the Satterfield charges were apparently converted to direct indictments and presented to the grand jury that way. What does this mean? It means the charges that fell under Newman's jurisdiction were now suddenly under Lee's jurisdiction. Not once was this mentioned to the public during the hearing on Monday. It's very unlikely that Mr. Murdoch is going to post that bond. And if he had an extra $7 million, well, he'd probably want to use it to pay restitution. Certainly would help, but he still more than likely needs to go to prison. All right, next on the docket, an update on the Michigan school massacre. A Michigan judge rejected the Oxford High School shooter's attorney's argument that the November 30th shooting incident that left four students deceased and seven wounded was simply an isolated incident, and basically stated that he has to remain in the adult jail. Now, Ethan Crumley, 15, appeared in court via video conference and heard his attorneys and the guardian ad litem ask the district court judge, Nancy Karnack, send him to a juvenile facility where he could return to school and get other help that he needs. The teen's court-appointed attorney, Paulette Lofton, noted that Mr. Crumley had never been in trouble before and has no history of assaulting kids or any other negative contact with his peers. This is an isolated incident that we are looking at here today, according to his attorneys. There are other juveniles housed at the Children's Village charged with murder. This would not be the first time. While the Oakland County Assistant Prosecutor Mark Keese rejected the defense argument, calling what happened a mass murder and saying it was premeditated and that he targeted the other juveniles. Karnack heard the argument and ruled that Crumley's placement in an adult jail was appropriate. She was, however, concerned that the teen can hear adult inmates from where he is, something that is prohibited by federal law for juveniles in an adult facility. The teenager has pled not guilty in this case, and his parents, James and Jennifer Crumley, who have been charged with four counts of involuntary manslaughter as well. The Crumleys bought their son the alleged semi-automatic handgun allegedly used in the shooting and insisted that he be returned to class the morning of the shooting after they were called into the school for a gruesome note that Ethan had written. Now, a lot of people didn't like my analysis that I think that this is a very novel argument by the district attorneys to charge the parents, and I stand by that based upon the information I have. For them to be legally responsible, they should have known that this child was going to go and shoot up the school. I have not seen any evidence that they knew that. Drawing pictures is not knowledge that he's going to do something. There's no knowledge, there's no information that they knew the child had the gun at the school. Had they known that, they would have taken it from him. The school didn't search his bag. The school's not being charged. So I get it. It's a highly charged political moment of the day. Prosecutors feel like they have to do something, and they're doing something. But I think at the end of the day, even if the parents are convicted on the appellate level, when they look at the cold, dry record, it's not going to stand. We'll see what takes place in the future. Obviously, we all don't have the information that the prosecutors have, but it'll be coming out shortly. Next on the docket, Derek Chauvin. Remember that guy? Yeah, the former Minneapolis police officer. He's expected to plead guilty in federal court regarding civil rights charges related to the death of George Floyd. Now, he's apparently added on to the docket for today, and he's previously pled not guilty. And as you may recall, obviously, he was found guilty of 3 counts relating to the death of Mr. George Floyd, second-degree unintentional murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter for pressing his knee against Mr. Floyd's back for more than 9 minutes. Why would he do such a thing? Well, there may be some sort of deal that he would be housed in a federal facility, which, although not great, you're still in prison. The federal facilities are usually a little nicer than the state court systems, and there may be some deal in place where he can serve his sentence in federal custody. We'll await further details. Now, here's an interesting issue that's going to be coming to the courts everywhere real soon, but the Massachusetts Supreme Court had to deal with it yesterday, and they're trying to reconcile arguments about police using cell phone location data to identify everyone who was within the vicinity of crime when there are no suspects otherwise. Now, normally, the police, if they have a suspect, will then obtain specific information from a carrier so that they can get that specific person's cell phone data to see if they're in the location of the crime. But what the police do now is they just ask for all cell phone data of everyone in that particular area. And now this case is up to at least one Supreme Court, expected to come to Supreme Courts near you, and ultimately, more than likely, to the United States Supreme Court. And this case in Massachusetts arose from a string of 6 similar armed robberies in the Boston area. The police had absolutely no suspects, but they got a warrant for a cell tower dump to identify the phone numbers of everyone in the area of the 6 robberies at the time, ultimately yielding 50,951 unique phone numbers. After police found a number that was present at many of the crimes, in this case, Jerron Perry was indicted on October of 2019. Perry faces murder charges because somebody died in one of the robberies, oftentimes known as felony murder. He aims to throw out the cell phone data, claiming it was scooped unconstitutionally because the police had no specific suspects and didn't even have any reason to think that the perpetrator had a phone with him or used it to commit the crime. A lower court rejected that argument back in April of 2021, and the high court agreed to review the matter on their calendars. Now, the briefs in this case went all the way back to Tudor England, when police could be given a general warrant to rummage through anyone's belongings, usually looking for Catholic or Puritan literature. And in the colonial era, British officials were often given a similar right to forcibly enter people's homes looking for untaxed goods. Now, the Founding Fathers wrote the 4th Amendment in response, stating that warrants require probable cause and a specific description of what is being searched. The United States Supreme Court held in 2018 that many cell phone data searches require a warrant. In this case, the police did get a warrant, so the question was how far police can legitimately go with a warrant. Most of the time, police already have a suspect, and they want to use the cell phone data to track the suspect's movement. What makes this case different is that the police were using cell phone data to find a suspect in the first place. Now, doesn't society have an objective expectation that you're not going to be caught up in a police search in this way? Well, Justice Scott Kafker asked during the arguments, noting that the idea that 50,000 people are potential suspects is, well, maybe just a bit much. And Perry's lawyer, Eric Tenen, argued, but you need probable cause for all the people searched. The government is searching all 50,000 people. Well, Justin Elspeth Seifner said the warrant was particularized because it wasn't searching everyone in the state, but particularly meant crafting the warrant so you're only searching people or places for which you have probable cause, Tenen said. Or things, interjected Justice Dalia Wendlandt. The things are the phone numbers that match. Now, Justice Serge George was troubled that the police simply assumed that the perpetrator had a cell phone. And Assistant District Attorney Kaylin Campbell replied that assuming people use a cell phone is reasonable. Now, Lowry agreed, saying that cell phones have become almost permanent attachment to our bodies. And Campbell also told the court that even if the police could theoretically misuse data about innocent people, there was no evidence that they did so in this particular case. Looking for a compromise, Kaffner suggested allowing the police to request only the numbers of people who matched all the crime scenes, not the thousands of innocent people who might have been near one of the crime scenes. So what if the police could only get the end product and not all the other slop, he asked. Wouldn't that be better? Well, yes, if the technology were there, according to Tenen. Now, Kaffner noted that Google had supplied similar data in a few cases. And if Google can do it, why can't the telephone companies do it? Well, you'd be surprised, said Campbell, echoing a common customer service complaint. It's extremely difficult, she sighed, to deal with the telephone companies. Interesting. So is expediency enough to basically make everyone, some 50,000 people, suspects in a particular case? I don't know. It's an interesting issue. But normally you need specific information as to one person. The justices are going to have a difficult call to make on this particular case. All right. Next on the docket, those responsible for the death of Ahmaud Arbery, well, they've got a sentencing date. A judge in Georgia has set a sentencing date early next year for the three men convicted in the murder and the killing of Ahmaud Arbery. Father and son Greg and Travis Lee McMichael and their neighbor William Roddy Bryan are set to be sentenced January 7th. At their trial in November, Travis McMichael, 35, was convicted of all nine charges. Greg McMichael, 65, was convicted of all charges except malice murder. Bryan, 52, convicted of three counts of felony murder and one count of aggravated assault, as well as false imprisonment and criminal attempt to commit false imprisonment. Needless to say, I don't think these gentlemen are ever getting out of custody, well, at least while they're breathing. Let's just put it that way. Hey, here's a reason why you don't go around trying to harm people. You're going to get caught. The married grandson of a Texas automotive tycoon, Eric Charles Mond, was indicted after he allegedly paid three men $750,000 to kidnap and murder his mistress and her current boyfriend, who threatened to expose the suspect's affair. Now, mistress Holly Williams, 33, and her partner, William Landway, 36, were found dead in Landway's crashed Acura sedan on March 12th of last year. The car had veered off the road, crashed into a tree, and the couple were both fatally shot several times. Three men, including Gilad Peled, 47, were also arrested that day and indicted on the same charges. Peled owns Austin-based Speartip Security, a business that helped clients respond to extortion demands, according to the Department of Justice indictment. Now, on Tuesday, December 7th, Eric Mond left a review on Google Review of the business. Speartip is very professional and on top of it. They get the job done in an expedient time. Couldn't imagine using anyone else. Allegedly, Mond paid Pallad and the other two men more than $750,000 to travel from Austin to Tennessee to kidnap, threaten, and intimidate the couple. On March 11th, the two men allegedly confronted Williams and Landway in the parking lot of their apartment complex in West Nashville with firearms. They shot Landway in the parking lot multiple times. They put his body in his own car and then used the car to kidnap William and drive her to nearby Old Hickory Boulevard, where she was shot several times. Now, according to the Department of Justice, within hours, Mond wired $750,000 from his bank account to an account controlled by Pled. It's unclear whether Eric Mond and Holly Williams were dating at the time of the murder. Well, guess what? Good old-fashioned police work and putting two and two together. And is that Google review? Is that a confession? Well, it certainly sounds like it, doesn't it? All right, next. How about a looting grandma? That's right. Grabbing grandmother Francel White, 53, and daughter Kimberly Cherry, 28, were two of the five looters nabbed by police over the November 19th incident that saw thieves make off with more than $1 million worth of designer goods. Now, the pair, along with the co-accused Tamiko Miller and Ivan Speed, have been charged with four felony counts of looting during a state of emergency, second-degree commercial burglary, grand theft, and receiving stolen property. Despite being slapped with serious charges and a combined 14 previous convictions, ranging from shoplifting to attempted murder, all five are now back on the street on bond. Cops say that Ivan Speed is now selling hoodies bearing the slogan, "No face, no case." We've talked about that, ladies and gentlemen. Now, according to court documents, shoplifter White's life of crime dates back 30 years. She's also been awarded $30,000 from taxpayer money in 2011 after she sued San Francisco School District, claiming a teacher had stolen her younger daughter's Twinkies. Eldest daughter Kimberly's criminal career kicked off in 2014 with a conviction of robbing the same branch of the JCPenney as her mother. The next year, she was busted shoplifting at Sears and was also found guilty of possessing burglary tools after cops discovered her 16-piece break-in kit, which included a screwdriver, a crowbar, two sets of pliers, and a selection of lock picks. In March of 2020, she was busted for cocaine possession, and in April of 2021, she was busted again for stealing toys from Bye Bye Baby. The final member of the looting gang, Speed, is also a career criminal who started his life of crime in 2006 in Oakland, California, where he has convictions for drug possession. Since then, he's gone on to commit further crimes, beginning with charge of attempted murder and other assaults with a firearm, as well as sexual battery dating back to 2007. In 2009, he was back in court again, this time for allegedly selling drugs. Most recently, Mr. Speed was most recently arrested in 2013 when he was hit with charges of being a felon in possession of a firearm and another carrying a loaded gun in public. In a statement, the San Francisco PD said they are continuing to investigate the looting spree and are confident that there will be further arrests. Well, you gotta admit it, a family that does crime together stays together. That's right, and they're gonna do time, that's for sure. Well, we can't say they're gonna do crime. You'd think if you go in and you steal things from people, you'd go to prison, right? Particularly if you had a history of doing that. Apparently not in California. Maybe that's why everyone's leaving California. It's just simply not a safe place to be. All right, here's a video you gotta see. Chicago police are searching for two men responsible for the theft of luxury watches from a high-end dealership on the Gold Coast Saturday. In a broad and brazen daylight, two suspects walk into a Lamborghini dealership and smash open a display case and steal $1 million worth of watches. Look at this video surveillance. You can see a man in the suit. He draws a gun and the suspects flee. No one was hurt during the robbery, but the perpetrators got away. Ladies and gentlemen, it only seems to be getting worse and more brazen. Maybe the legislature is going to have to pass a law saying that you can use deadly force to protect personal property. Right now, you really can't do that. All right, finally, our dumb criminal of the day. Please meet Patrick D. Beeman of Sheboygan, Wisconsin. Patrick has been going on a crime spree that is really one of a kind. Patrick is known as the serial toilet clogger. That's right. He has the Sheboygan, Wisconsin area on high alert, and he's been killing toilets. After finally being caught, Patrick was sentenced to 150 days in jail for his trail of toilet destruction. While being arrested, Patrick told authorities, "I need to make things right and pay for forgiveness every day." That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Destroying toilets. Clogging them up and destroying toilets. Who does that? Why? That's why he's our dumb criminal of the day. All right. Thanks for watching. Please join us tonight, 6 p.m. Mountain Time, for our Tuesday night live show. I think we're captioning it now, Crime Talk After Dark. Ooh, don't you like that? Ooh, and we're going to have a guest tonight. So please join us, 6 p.m. Mountain Time. Thanks for watching Crime Talk.